dead and one slightly wounded soldier. We don't know either man. Some of the soldiers tell us that they have found German rations and cigarettes in the Soviet soldiers' kit bags. On the wrist of a commissar, they also found a German Thieler wristwatch with a name inscribed under the second lid. The driver from the supply vehicle will give them to the Pionier Hauptmann. We spend the night in the new positions. It's bloody cold, and an icy easterly wind penetrates into our very bones. Anyone not on watch at an observation post sits huddled in his cold foxhole and dozes until morning. 25th of November. Even before it gets light, we have orders to board our vehicles. We make for the village and reoccupy the old positions and trenches scattered around on the steppe. That saves us a lot of hard work, because the ground is frozen so hard in the top layers that you can only break up the soil with picks. In good weather, we can see for many kilometres across the steppe, but unfortunately in some places the enemy can also see into our trenches. We have almost daily incidents involving snipers hitting our men. These snipers are extremely well hidden, and we have a very hard time seeing them. Rations and ammunition supplies are therefore always brought in at night, although even then it's dangerous. We assume that the snipers are aiming their rifles at the critical points during the daylight hours, and then occasionally pulling the triggers also at night. It is quiet at first this morning, but later on the Soviets launch an attack on Shir Station with tanks and infantry. To begin with, we were only spectators to the action, but then we were also attacked with mortars and machine guns. The enemy came for us very suddenly, as if they had risen out of the ground. We learned later from prisoners that they had crawled up to with only a few hundred metres of us and had dug themselves in under the protection of a small hillock. The breezy easterly masked any noise made by their digging. While we hold down the infantry in front of us with aimed fire, a T-34 tank leaves its formation of five and comes at us from the other side of the Rachel, firing continuously. He stops at the edge of the Rachel with his broadside towards us. I've never seen an enemy tank this close before, and it looks very menacing. It has white camouflage paint, and its steel turret swings round as the gun is lowered towards the target. The thundering shot shakes it up a bit, and there is a small jet of flame from the muzzle, followed by a brief smoke trail. The hit behind us registers at just about the same second. Then the powerful diesel engine revs up, and the monster moves off, its tracks clanking along the edge of the Rachel. I am showered with debris. Just don't get spotted. He knows that we're lying here, but maybe he hasn't noticed our well-camouflaged bunker. He must have realized that we haven't got any anti-tank weapons here in this sector. In spite of this, he moves carefully before he drives through the flat swell at the end of our Rachel before entering it. One shot from an AT or 88mm AA gun would knock him. He is standing with his broadside towards us. But I know full well that our AT weapons are guarding the railway line and the village. Suddenly he backs up and tries to turn, but he doesn't manage it very well, and then puts a track on the edge of the Rachel, causing bits of it to break off. Now I can see some pioneers in the Rachel. They're working with something. It looks like a bar or a pole. Then I'm interrupted by Weichert, who is beside me and is making me aware of the infantry, who have advanced under the protection of the tank. What should I do? Shoot? Yes, I have to. Otherwise they will overrun us, even if it means that the T-34 will discover our position. I squeeze myself behind the machine gun and pull the trigger. Weichert feeds in the belt. At about the same time, Meinhardt and the others also fire at the attacking infantry. The first row of men falls to the ground, and the others throw themselves down. There is no cover for them on the snow-covered steppe. What is the tank doing? He has spotted us and is turning his turret towards us. Then he lowers his gun and aims directly at us. He is barely 15 meters away. It would be crazy to stand there and fire, so I pull down the machine gun from its position and cover myself with the others in the trench. The resulting explosion is mixed with shrapnel as the shell strikes home just meters behind us.
This time we were fortunate, but next time we'll have had it, says Weichert.
A chill runs down my spine. Svina brings relief from the terrible excitement.
"The tank is destroyed!" he calls out.
We move up and can see that the tank is hanging over the edge of the Rachel with a broken track. From the rear of the vehicle comes thick black smoke, which quickly dissipates. Someone calls out,
The pioneers got him with a hollow charge.
We breathe more easily and are grateful to the men in the pioneer unit. Later, the Unteroffizier der Pioniere tells me it was a piece of cake because the T-34 didn't notice them under the edge of the Rachel and had positioned itself directly over them, so they could attach their homemade charge of hand grenades under the track quite easily. Even so, they were almost killed by the broken bits of track. Today we have been fairly fortunate. The tank fire caused only 3 lightly wounded. The pioneers were forced to smoke the crew out. They had kept still for hours inside their vehicle, hoping for rescue by their own people. They crawl out, and I take a look at them. I have a strange feeling, a mixture of curiosity, threat, and respect. I'm quite surprised to see their helmets, which can best be described as a number of blown-up bicycle inner tubes sewn together, one next to the other. What purpose they serve, I don't know. Perhaps they're a form of sound insulation and a protection against the cold. 26th of November. Today begins with ground fog. It dissipates in the winter sun, giving us good fields of views. German bombers, accompanied by fighter escorts, drone around unmolested in the clear blue, cloudless sky. Gommel identifies them as HE-111s and DO-17s. I have often seen the slim ME-109s, the escort fighters, in air combat. Once in a while, we also recognize the heavy JU-52, the so-called Tante U, which is used for freight and as a troop transport. All of them are flying heavily loaded to Stalingrad, and when they are lucky, they come back empty. Varias and Svina were down in the village early to get clean underwear and lice powder from our kit bags. The little beasts have multiplied incredibly quickly on me, and I have already rubbed my entire upper torso. Varias says that 2 days ago the Führer declared Stalingrad to be a fortress. Some of the soldiers, those who were in Stalingrad, are furious when they hear it. They are angry at the way the war is being conducted, and because they are no longer given any opportunity to escape the encirclement. They speak quite openly of being sacrificed in a pocket which is surrounded by an enemy force superior to any before. Others believe the encirclement will shortly be breached by the approaching tank units commanded by General Oberst Hort. I, and most of the reserve unit personnel, believe the latter. However, this optimism is built on wishful thinking, and it falls to pieces like a pack of cards. As even the lowliest soldier knows, the combat strength of our enemy grows steadily day by day, while we, with our inadequate weaponry, become weaker. Added to this come the days when we are only able to satisfy our rumbling stomachs with a handful of Hartzwieback. It is not lost on anyone that we remain here in a totally isolated outpost and are to be sacrificed for some strategic purpose or other. It will be at the beginning of December, only a question of days away, when Soviet superiority will grind us to pieces. On the afternoon of this day, the 26th of November, we have, however, received a boost to our morale in the form of an 88mm anti-aircraft gun, which is to be used in the ground defence role. We also get a 20mm quad AA gun on a wheeled carriage. Before the 88mm is taken into position on the hillock, the ground is dug out so that only a little of the white-painted protective shielding of the gun can be seen from the front. As of yesterday, there are supposed to be 3 tanks in the village to give support, but because of a shortage of ammunition, they are to be used only in an absolute emergency. 27th of November. During the early hours, an enemy reconnaissance patrol is able to gain entry into the village. We hear the gunshots. The emergency response unit manages to take some prisoners. Afterwards, the Soviets pound the village for hours with heavy artillery. During the morning, we're also bombarded with mortars and Stalinorgon. However, they do not attack. Yesterday, the pioneers mined part of the village, but unfortunately one of our drivers, in a personnel carrier, ran onto one of the mines and was blown into the air. Because of the heavy shelling, we are sitting like moles in the ground for much of the time, occasionally checking to see whether the enemy has started his attack yet. It is my turn to keep watch, and I carefully raise my head up over the lip of the trench, but just then a grenade explodes right on the edge. The hot splinters zip past my head, and my ears ring like mad. Dirt and debris rain down on heads and down the necks of those in the trench, but the roof holds. The snow around us has for the last few hours been no longer white, but rather mixed in with brown dirt because of all the explosions. It is bloody hard and wearing to sit in a hole in the ground and wait. What for? No one knows exactly. Only that it is about our lives, that much we know for sure. Maybe we will take a direct hit, which will end what little is left of our lives. When that happens, we'll probably not notice anything. It would be bad enough if the enemy were attacking en masse. At least you can defend yourself. But here, in this awful hole, you can do nothing except wait. I try to think about other things, but can't. The howling and the crashing explosions over and around us banish all other thoughts, and there is only the fervent wish that this nerve-wracking din will finally stop. The only person seemingly unaffected is Sfina. I can't see excitement and fear in his face like I can with the others. But then how could he feel these emotions? The poor devil can't hear the crashes and the whining of the shells. He looks at us unconcernedly and asks us what we're doing. To talk to him, you must go right up to him and shout. Then he understands. The artillery barrage lasts almost 2 hours, proof that they do not have to be too sparing with their ammunition. They haven't achieved much. Apart from a damaged machine gun and a filled-in trench, there's no harm done. 28th of November. The night of the 27th to the 28th of November passes quietly, but Meinhardt brings bad news early in the morning. He says that our Spieß and another Wachtmeister from the unit fell yesterday morning. Although we weren't that close to our Wachtmeister, he always kept his distance from us newcomers. We were still pretty shocked. What's more, he was our linchpin and our superior, and in spite of his serious nature, he always concerned himself with our well-being, as much as he was able to here in the bridgehead anyway. Now he is among us no more. There are only two service grades left in our company, the Schiermeister and Unteroffizier Döring. Meinhardt says that in peacetime the Spieß served with the cavalry and that the job of the soldier was made for him. It doesn't seem to get all that light today. It stays hazy and cloudy, and the visibility is so bad that we have to be really careful in case the enemy suddenly looms up in front of us. Döring therefore sends several men to man the observation posts up ahead. Meinhardt reckons that the Soviets will make use of the weather to get up close to us. As it turns out, he's right. Shortly after this, the observers come back to report that they've heard noises coming from the north and have heard commands in Russian getting louder and louder. They hadn't, however, been able to see anything, but there is no doubt that the enemy is on his way from the north. They hadn't heard any tank engines. Okay, so it's the infantry first. We're ready, and we'll give them a warm welcome. Döring sends word that we will open fire only on his command. He intends to let them come close, to within a certain range, and then take them by surprise with crossfire. We are standing with our weapons and getting excited. No one knows what will come at us. These are the worst minutes before combat, when everything in your body is at the highest level of excitement. The minutes become eternities. Then, they're here. The first figures approach, bent double, out of the haze, coming right for us. Everyone's waiting for the signal to fire. Pity I don't have any field glasses, because something seems odd, something that I can't quite understand. Someone yells, "Those are our boys! Don't fire!" Then Döring, "Keep your heads down! Everyone stay down!" We do as we're told and keep looking. The soldiers in front of us are coming closer, and I can see those in front waving. Where have they come from, I am thinking, because their uniforms and steel helmets appear so new. Then Meinhardt's machine gun hammers away, and someone is yelling, "They're Russians! In our uniforms!" The figures in the German uniforms are storming forward in an attempt to overrun us. Behind them come the others, in mud-brown overcoats and dirty camouflage uniforms. We lay down crossfire from all our machine guns and carbines. Those who have not been hit throw themselves to the ground. The attack stops. In front of us we hear shouts. Then two Soviet machine guns let loose. A rain of bullets comes towards us, and mortar rounds explode all over the place. Another centimetre, and one of them would have taken out my machine gun. I pull it back and crouch down. "They are attacking again," calls Weichert as he feeds another belt of ammunition in. It's a weird sensation firing on an enemy wearing your own uniform. It's as if you're shooting traitors. They are trying to overrun us in a second and third wave, but they don't make it, especially when the pioneers fire at them from the flank. There are an awful lot of dead bodies lying around on the snow in front of us, which are gradually freezing solid and getting covered by whirling snowflakes. We can hear the wounded groaning and calling out for help, but we can't do anything for them. Some of the dead even have German felt boots on, which we ourselves are in desperate need of. Where possible, these are removed from the stiff, frozen feet of the dead and put to use again. I can't find a pair to fit me, and so I keep my own boots on. Many of the soldiers even help themselves to the primitive ear flaps the Russians are wearing. They seem to be made out of a single piece of pressed felt, but they serve their purpose in the cold. My boots were too large during the summer, but if I hadn't put on an extra pair of very thick socks and placed some newspaper wadding in the boots, my toes would undoubtedly have got frostbite at the start of the winter, like so many other people's did. For this reason, a couple of days ago we received some rather unpretentious-looking overshoes made out of woven straw, which Svina dubbed Strohpotschen. Although we can't take very big strides when we're wearing them, they do insulate our feet quite well against the cold ground when we are standing around in our foxholes. Weichert and some of the others are also checking the kit bags of the dead Soviet soldiers, as we have not received any rations since yesterday evening other than a piece of army bread and half-warm tea. Weichert suffers from hunger more than any of us. He finds some black Russian army bread and some pieces of smoked meat, which also originate from German supplies. Svina brings a large bag of mazorka for me, as he has noticed that I've been turning my pockets inside out all morning to salvage a pinch of tobacco for my pipe. Tonight we again place the observation posts way out ahead. When Grommel wakes us at about 0300, it is quite cozy in the bunker, but to make up for that, very much colder outside. Everything is covered with rime because of the fog. The machine gun, wrapped in a canvas ground sheet, appears as a white, indeterminate lump. Behind us, on the hillock, a flare goes up. The view from there is better. The fog is thicker in the hollow in front of us. Often we can't even see our hands in front of our faces. I trudge with Svina into the haze. The snow crunches under our boots, and we follow the tracks. Then comes a muffled request for the password.
"Railway," I answer quietly.
"Come over here."
I hear a voice which seems to be familiar, but I can't see anybody.
"We are to your right, in the foxhole," says the voice.
Then suddenly a figure stands in front of us, and another is climbing out of the foxhole. Damn this thick fog. If they had not challenged us, we might have stepped on them. They report that it's been quiet out front. As soon as the fog has swallowed them up, Svina leaps into the foxhole. I still need to orient myself a bit. I'm only a few meters away from Svina, but I can't hear or see anything of him. I only know roughly where he should be. Bloody fog. I stumble over a dead body and realize that I am too far out front. I do not feel very well, and crouch down as I think I can hear crunching footsteps. More dead bodies are scattered around. An uncanny feeling is coming over me, and I am regretting that I left Svina. I can't call him because he can't hear me. But again I hear those crunching footsteps and muffled voices. Soviets! The thought flashes before me. Now don't panic, I think. My nerves are stretched to the limit. I reckon the Russians often stand around and then call to each other. They manage to keep in contact with each other in the thick fog in this way. Slowly I back away from the noises, and almost step on Svina's head. For him it must be an awful feeling, to be unable to see or hear in the fog. I indicate to him that something is happening in front of us, and it seems almost grotesque when he cups his hand and places it behind his ear to listen. We then creep back and tell the others. We wait until we can hear the voices quite clearly. Then Döring fires off a flare. It lights up only a small area, cold and ghost-like. Some figures stand stiff and immobile, as if with roots in the ground. Then suddenly they disperse. The first ones throw themselves onto the ground. We fire into the darkness. The Russians are yelling something to each other. Then we hear some clatter, which retreats rapidly. A second and then a third flare go up. Five figures are still lying on the snow. The others have disappeared. We assume they are from a Soviet reconnaissance unit, or men who have lost their way. It's only a small group. We fire a few rounds. In the light of another tracer, I see two figures leap up and run back. One is hit and falls down. Three are still lying in the snow. Someone from our side is calling out something in Russian. It must be one of our Russian volunteers who was with the supply trains and is now helping us. A Russian is answering him, then stands up and raises his hands. The other two follow him. Among the three prisoners are two women, which we refer to as Flint and Viber. They are said to be more fanatical even than the Soviet soldiers. They do not have much to hide, and say they got lost in the fog with a group of 15 soldiers. We are well aware of their front lines, and also of the fact that their positions are being strengthened day by day. 2nd of December. After thick morning fog, it is now clearing up. There is considerable enemy activity in the direction of Chir Station. I walk along the trench towards Meinhardt's position. He has been talking to Döring, who has been scanning with his field glasses.
"Döring thinks the Soviets are planning for an attack," says Meinhardt. "He has seen lots of vehicles and tanks. Apparently they are moving replacements in by transport."
Meinhardt is annoyed that the Russians have the audacity to form up in front of us, calm as you like.
"Those swine know full well that we have no artillery, otherwise they would never have the cheek," he grumbles.
We watch the enemy for another hour, then we realize that the bulk of their formation is moving southeast towards Verkhnye Chirskye. Another combat unit is supposed to be securing the bridge over the Don. When the Russians take the bridge, they will be in our rear and will have us in the bag. The flashes tell us that their attack is supported by well-equipped tank units. Three of these dreadful steel monsters are coming along the railway line towards us right now. Suddenly, there are loud engine noises overhead.
"Our Stukas are here!"
some of the soldiers cry out excitedly. The stress and anxiety within us vanishes in a trice, and we start cheering like children who've just opened a present. So there is some contact with High Command after all. Can it have come from the south bank of the Don? Only later do I find that there is in fact no connection. The pilots had realized what was going on from the air and had acted accordingly. Later, Stuka support is again carried out without any reference to us. Nevertheless, each time they come, they are greeted excitedly, and they help lift our spirits, if only temporarily. First, there is a flight of three Stukas, which dive down, then three more follow. Their attack in front of us is a real spectacle, but even for us non-participants, it brings a cold, creepy feeling to the spine. The fearsome shark mouths painted on the engine cowlings give the enemy a premonition of the catastrophe that is about to be visited on them. The aircraft first roll to the side, then, with the deafening wail from their sirens getting louder and louder, swoop down on their target. As soon as they have released their bombs, the planes climb steeply, only to dive again on another target. The effect on the morale of those on the receiving end must be terrible. It is just like the inferno of hell, even though the action is taking place far away from us. Within the next few minutes, black clouds of smoke billow into the clear sky. We notice that some of the tanks are moving in zigzag fashion to escape the attacking dive bombers. They don't really have a chance, because the Stukas are over them again and again, sending their bombs down. When they have dropped their bombs, the aircraft turn and disappear over the horizon. Smoke clouds, large and small, show how many targets were hit and destroyed, mostly vehicles, tanks, and heavy weapons. The Stukas have accomplished a great deal, and the Russian infantry has been halted by the combat group south of the Don. We can quite clearly see that the Don Bridge has not been captured by the enemy. But how long will things last? 3rd of December. The ration orderlies bring us thin, cold coffee, which we first have to heat on the stove. Each four men receive half a can of beef and a canteen full of zvibak. That has to last until tomorrow evening. Gromel counts out each mouthful of zvibak so that everyone receives exactly the correct amount. It is more than we received yesterday, when we got one loaf of bread, already mildewed, among three men. Typically, during this period of the war, hunger so completely dominates our thinking that even the constant worry about our survival takes a back seat. The main topic of conversation is food. Even at night I dream about food, and even dream about a delicious roast being cooked in the oven. Waking up is therefore that much more difficult, particularly when I discover that the noise is only a loud rumble in my empty stomach. Our lives are re-energized when we get enough dry army bread to eat. I chew it slowly in my mouth and savor the exquisite taste. I would even forego the best cakes. I would never have thought bread could be so delicious. But on many days even bread is unavailable. It is taken for granted in normal times, but it's really precious now. Chapter 5. Blood-red snow falls not from the sky. December the 4th, 1942. The day begins like yesterday, not many clouds in the sky and clear visibility. Later the clouds gather and get grey. During the afternoon it begins to snow, and the cold wind blows and forms drifts. Before long, the brown and white checked ground around us is again white and clean. I'm shoveling the snow out of the connecting trenches, and the work is warming me up. Weichert is making sure that the field of fire for our machine gun remains unobstructed. I go to visit Varias, Zeidel, and the others in the neighboring bunker, and walk through the connecting trench. They have fired up their oven, so much so that it's glowing. When I see Varias, I have to laugh. He is lying stretched out in the bunker with his lower legs disappearing into the clay wall, as if cut off. Their bunker is just like ours, an enlarged covered trench, but it is too narrow for Varias's long legs, so he has excavated a hole in the wall to accommodate the rest of his stilts. Two other soldiers are lying on the straw-covered ground beside him, both snoring. I can hear their stomachs murmur, and Varias says that if you sleep, you save power and energy. Zeidel is standing by the oven, stirring something in his mess tin. He says that when you cook up a hot soup of bits of zwieback and snowmelt, it lasts longer in the stomach than it would if you force it down dry. He might be onto something here. I will have to try it sometime. You can hear the harmonica again, in Meinhardt's bunker. Kurat's playing some really sad tunes, bringing back memories from home. They were forever telling us at training camp how to service and use our weapons in order to kill our enemies, and we were trained and proud to fight for Führer, Volk und Vaterland, and, if necessary, die. But no one told us what you might have to go through before you got killed, nor that death might not be instantaneous. There are many forms. In the few days we've been here, we've heard the awful screams of the wounded. How terrible it must be to die lying on the frozen ground. The thought fills us with horror. We might lie there with nobody to help us. We weren't told that this might happen, nor were we told how we could cope with the anxiety that eats away at you like fire and is far more powerful than the impulse to do your duty. Each soldier will have to solve that problem for himself, they said. But more than anything, he will have to hide his anxiety so that the others don't notice it. If he doesn't hide it, his anxiety might be interpreted as cowardice, as in the case of little Grommel, who even while under attack can't bring himself to fire on the enemy. Weichert has also noticed that Grommel can't aim and pull the trigger. Even when he is forced to shoot, he closes his eyes as he pulls the trigger, so he can't see where he's shooting. Yet he was one of the best shots in the training camp. What is the matter with him? Do his nerves fail when he sees the enemy, just like Petsch? Weichert has noticed that every time the enemy attacks, he acts as if he's lame, and his eyes flicker and water as though he is in a fever. Maybe I'll talk to him about it, particularly as it affects the safety of all of us. Unfortunately, I never get the chance, because over the next few days we are constantly under attack. The few peaceful moments we have, those of us not on guard duty, are used for sleep. We are always overtired. This evening I go and see Meinhardt in his bunker again. Unteroffizier Döring is also there, and tells us he'll be returning to the village to pick up his harmonica as soon as he has the chance. On the way to the bunker, I hear soft tunes wafting from Kurat's harmonica. I cannot know that I will see him alive only one more time. He and another chum will be casualties in a day or so. 5th of December. It snows again during the night. When Weichert and Svina wake me in the morning, there is a wild firefight going on in the village. According to Weichert, it has just begun. He and Svina came back from the observation post and hadn't noticed anything particularly unusual, but now all hell is let loose in the village. The frosty air is filled with the sharp crack of tank and anti-tank guns, with the rattle of rifle and machine gun fire in between. A soldier comes running up, yelling that they need the quad anti-aircraft gun. The engine of the towing vehicle is quickly started up, and the quad moves along the hillock towards the village. Flares are constantly shooting up from over there. The thin, flaky snow makes the darkness seem even hazier.
"Just the weather for a Russian attack,"
comments an old Obergefreiter as he crawls through the trench. Then the quad gets into action. There is no mistaking its low staccato firing. Fires are blazing at two places in the village. Soon the firefight dies away, and the only firing now comes from the railway line in the direction of Chir. It is machine gun fire. During the sudden lull, loud engine noises can be heard coming from the Rachel, and heavy diesel fumes penetrate our noses. Cooper and Varias come over towards us. We assume it must be a T-34 stuck in the Rachel, because the droning noise of the engine starts up and then dies down again, always coming from the same spot. We crawl up to the edge of the Rachel, which falls away steeply. We can see nothing, it's much too hazy, but we're in no doubt that the tank has got bogged down.
"This is our chance to blast it, but how and with what?" asks Varias.
As if in answer to his question, there is an explosion and the tank is literally blown apart. We are blinded by the fire and throw ourselves flat onto the ground. The tank's ammunition explodes in the heat, ricocheting back and forth between the walls of the Rachel. In the pale light of the breaking dawn, we can see thick smoke oozing out of the engine compartment. The pioneers call over to us that they have destroyed it with a couple of mines. In the counter-attack that follows, we capture a lot of weapons, but we find very little food in the kit bags. Weichert manages to scrounge a few bits of black Soviet army bread, which tastes of dough, and because of its texture feels like sandpaper when it is chewed. However, we still gulp it down, in order to satisfy some of our hunger. From time to time I can again hear, away to the right, those revolting muffled shots to the head being carried out by the black sergeant, who will no doubt justify his brutality the same way as before. 6th of December. Three of us are dozing away in the warm bunker. Weichert has been on night duty outside. We can hear his footsteps in the hard frost coming closer. As he stands in front of the bunker and lifts the blanket away from the opening, we are wide awake. In spite of being permanently overtired, we still sleep mostly like rabbits, with one eye open and ears alert for any unusual noises. Weichert tells us that Döring has been issued with several cases of ammunition, and that we are to pick up our share. It is still quite dark when Grommel and I go over to see Döring. Kurat is still not back. Apparently his observation post still has 20 minutes left on this shift. Everything seems to be quiet, and we hope it will stay that way. As I go to enter the bunker, I seem to hear Kurat's harmonica. But that is not possible. Kurat is at an observation post in a foxhole out in front. Am I mistaken? Are my nerves so frayed that I'm hearing things? I walk back to Varias. Both he and Zeidel have heard it. Not a tune, just two loud notes, as if someone has just breathed into it. They also were wondering what it was. When we tell Döring about it, he at once takes action.
Something is wrong. Alert! Give the alarm! Ready to fire!
I run over to my machine gun and pull the cover off. The entire unit is now on the alert and waiting. For what? Everything is quiet in front of us. Could Kurat accidentally have blown into his harmonica? If he'd noticed anything, he would have warned us with a rifle shot, as per the usual procedure. Could this be a false alarm? The shift should now be finished, so perhaps they are waiting for the new shift to take over. Döring holds everything up. Then a tracer spirals up in the air. What's that? Less than 50 meters in front of us, we see figures in white snow camouflage battle dress. When we fire our machine guns and rifles at them, they throw themselves into the snow. As it gets lighter, we can see more Russians. They lie behind the first group, also in camouflaged battle dress, ready to jump up. The pioneers are shooting at them too from the flank. They stay lying in the snow, waiting. Half an hour passes. Why don't they attack? What next? What are they waiting for? We know soon enough. tanks. First, we can make out only two, then another three emerge from the haze of the breaking dawn. They advance towards us and fire at our positions. What is our 88mm doing? It is camouflaged and certainly awaiting its chance. The thought calms us only a little. What good is one gun against five T-34s? The Soviet infantry follows up under cover of the tanks in a dispersed file. We try to keep them down. Then, like a bolt of lightning from the clear sky, comes firing from the 88mm. We see a glowing armor-piercing shell slam against a T-34, causing a jet of flame and then thick, black, acrid smoke. The barrel of the 88mm has already been lined up at the next target. The shell goes right into the track of the tank. The vehicle can now only spin in circles. The tank crew has just got enough time to jump out before a second shot, a bullseye, destroys the tank. Another tank tries to escape into the blind spot of the 88. Two T-34s fire on the 88. Their shells come close. One ricochets like a fireball from a snowdrift and slams into the bunker to our right. We hear yells and calls for the medic. Then the third tank is hit. He can't work his turret anymore. With his barrel angled and immobile, he tries to escape to the rear. Minutes later, the other one follows him. The tank which had crept into the blind spot of the 88 now steps out of the frying pan into the fire. As he tries to move into a firing position to wipe out the 88, he is standing exactly under the guns of two of our tanks, which have been waiting for him behind the hillock. Before they destroy him, however, he manages to damage one of them quite seriously. Although we have again managed to counter the enemy attack, we have had to pay dearly. The T-34 hit on our bunker has killed the promising tank rifleman Dieter Malzahn and a Gefreiter. Three others are seriously wounded, one having had half of his arm torn off. Only later in the day, when the heavy Russian shelling eases off, can we again move into the area in front of our position. Beside the foxholes at the observation post, we find Kurat and his chum in their own frozen pools of blood. The Soviets have slaughtered them and taken their boots and rifles. Kurat can't have been killed instantly because he managed to warn us with his harmonica. As we carry the two corpses back with us to give them a decent burial, Kurat is still holding his harmonica in his limp hand. He has saved our lives, for without his warning the enemy would surely have taken us by surprise and massacred us. Today has been another bad day for us, and we, the survivors, have again been granted a reprieve by him above. Grommel reminds us that today is St. Nicholas's Day and Sunday. What is that? For us there are no more holidays, only survival, and every day we remain alive is a good day. I will sleep rather fitfully tonight.
7th of December. The weather this morning is hazy again. During the morning it clears up so that the visibility gets quite good. The enemy snipers are firing like mad again. We have three incidents during the morning. At the station, the Soviets are attacking separately and are firing their mortars into the village. When our Stukas arrive, everything becomes quiet. They bomb the Russian positions in front of us. The Soviets have camouflaged themselves so well in the white snow that we are surprised how close they've been able to get without our noticing them. The dive bombers throw themselves at the Russians in several waves. We have become used to their wailing sirens when they dive. The many black clouds of smoke make it obvious that they have also hit vehicles and heavy weapons, but they still couldn't stop the enemy attacking us that afternoon with artillery and mortar fire. Only the Stalinorgeln were not involved. Were they perhaps destroyed by the dive bombers? For our evening meal, we unexpectedly received bean soup with potatoes and some bread. Jansen managed to bring back some food supplies for us over the Don. 8th of December. Today is pretty much the same as yesterday. The visibility is good, and the dive bombers start bombarding the Russian positions early. This time they are operating further back. The Russians must have pulled together strong forces on the heights behind Scheer Station. The dive bombers attack for a second time, in several waves, and lob their bombs onto their targets, and inky black smoke rises up into the blue sky. 9th of December. A grey morning,
and the enemy is firing with all his heavy weapons into the village and into our positions. Until noon, we can peer only with the utmost of caution over the edges of our bunkers. The terrible waiting game has begun again. The Soviets are undoubtedly getting their own back for the dive bomber attacks, which today will not take place owing to the poor visibility. During the afternoon, they attack the village both from the east and along the railway line from the south. We, however, are not involved. If they do manage to take the village, they'll be able to attack us from two sides and leave us vulnerable to a pincer movement. We wait and pray that they will not succeed. The fight for the village lasts several hours. Then the reserve unit manages to counterattack and drive the Russians back out of the village again. The losses are great. 6 dead and many wounded. 11th of December. The entire sky is grey today, and so visibility is limited. Since early morning, shells have been exploding all around us. The Russians don't want to give us any respite, it seems. Because of the explosions, we don't hear any engine noises and don't realize the danger which is about to descend on us. Suddenly, like phantoms, 5 T-34 tanks are standing in front of us. They surprise not only us, but also the crew of the 88mm gun deployed for ground support behind us on a knoll. Before the crew can traverse the long barrel to aim at the tanks, all 5 of the latter fire simultaneously. This surprise fire, at this short range, means the end for the 88. Surprisingly, the crew manages to destroy one of the 5 tanks before receiving 2 direct hits. We see pieces of armour and bodies fly through the air. The men are killed instantly. The 4 T-34s now advance triumphantly directly towards us, the Russian infantry clinging on like grapes. But the Quad AA is still firing. Its tracer rounds are hitting the tanks and are forcing the infantry to get down and seek cover behind their vehicles. 2 T-34s are nearing the edge of the trench in front of us, but turn away. They drive along it with their sides towards us until they come to Meinhardt's position. This is an opportunity every tank destroyer dreams about. However, they know that we no longer have any means to destroy them. We fire from all barrels on the infantry following the tanks, but the latter keep on rolling until they come to Meinhardt's position. Some of the Russians who have dared to advance towards us are cut down by our fire. Hand grenades explode close to Varias and Meinhardt. Then, suddenly, Meinhardt's machine gun stops firing, although all the others continue. The tracer rounds from the Quad AA swish over our heads, aimed at the waves of Soviet infantry soldiers bearing down. Without the Quad, we would have been overrun long ago. The sappers are also firing their 2 machine guns from our flank into the decimated ranks of the Soviet infantry. The first tank halts on top of Meinhardt's position. The engine roars more loudly. He is now turning on the spot and churning up the ground with his tracks as he does so. The Quad AA is now firing at point-blank range at the T-34 with explosive rounds, but they have no more effect on the thick turret armour than firecrackers. Then it happens. The tank that has broken through our lines to the right is firing at close range directly at the Quad. The second round hits and smashes the weapon. Pieces of metal and various body parts fly through the air and land back on the snow over a wide area. A torn-off leg, still wearing a felt boot, hits the ground only a few meters from us. The blood pumping out of the leg slowly colors the snow red. We look at each other helplessly, our faces flushed. Despite the cold, sweat is running down from my forehead into my eyes. My mouth is dry, and my tongue is glued to the roof of my palate. Now the tanks are free to roam about, roll up our positions, and take them over. Then there will be nothing to prevent them from advancing into the village and wreaking havoc there. But at least they have mines in the village, and one of the tanks might not be serviceable. More than that, we don't know. One of the tanks stays near us and continues to churn up the ground. Another ploughs up the ground near Zeidel and further over on the right flank, while a third tries to get to the village over the hill. The fourth tank has already managed to negotiate the hill and is firing continuously into the village. In spite of our determined defense, several Soviet soldiers still manage to break into our positions. They are disarmed by Döring and his men in hand-to-hand fighting. Now only my machine gun and those of the two sappers are still firing. Weichert, who feeds my ammo belt, complains about the poor quality of the ammunition and the many cartridges which are torn by the ejectors in the breaches. We have only one replacement barrel left in reserve. Zvina stands beside me, firing a carbine as fast as he can. He stays down there, reloading with nervous hands. I don't see Grommel, as he is standing several meters beyond Weichert. He quickly throws him two machine gun barrels with cartridges plugged in the breeches.
Unplug the casings, Kleiner. You're good at that, he calls to him.
Just then he ducks down and exclaims in astonishment, Bugger! Now the T-34 has discovered our machine gun nest. The T-34 turns its turret towards our position and comes at us, its engine roaring. I pull my machine gun into the trench and throw myself down. Grommel and Weichert dash into the bunker. Zvina is already lying behind me in the trench. A harsh metallic shot, and a tank shell explodes exactly where my machine gun once stood. Frozen dirt and hot splinters rain down over my head. There is a loud ringing in my ears, and it feels as if my eardrum has just been perforated. The acrid powder is sucked into my nose and fills my lungs. But I live, and so does Svina. I can hear his convulsive coughing behind me. And there it is again, the rattle and the roaring, as steel tank tracks grind squealing on their rollers. A deathly noise. I press myself like a worm onto the ground. In the trench, everything goes dark. The steel monster is parked directly on top of me, blocking out the daylight. Now the sharp steel tracks are tearing up the edge of the trench. Frozen blocks of dirt fall onto my back and half cover me. Will the monster bury me alive? I remember soldiers telling me that tanks have turned on top of foxholes until the men below could no longer move and suffocated in the dirt. A hell of a way to die. I'm panic-stricken. Maybe it's safer with the others in the bunker. I crawl on my knees to join them, and Svina follows me. The bunker is almost dark, and I can hardly recognize the faces of the others, but I sense the fear and the restlessness in the air. The tank now stands on top of us. What will he do? Will he turn and try to collapse the bunker? The earth is frozen solid, but will the roof of the bunker be able to take the weight? Terrible minutes tick by, during which we can do nothing but wait. Wait for death? We might try to dispatch it with a mine or a magnetic-shaped charge, but we have neither of these to hand, so we can only hope and pray that the death will pass us by. I hear Svina start to pray out loud, and I feel that I also need to steady my nerves by prayer. I haven't prayed since I was a child, believing in my youth that I was strong enough not to need the help of a higher being. But now, facing death and fearing for my life, those long-forgotten words come to mind. I don't say them out loud like Svina and the others. I pray quietly within, without moving my lips. I pray that we will be saved from serious injury and from a ghastly death. Although nothing in our situation has changed, I do sense after my prayer an inner peace and faith, which I can't explain very well in words. Svina has also finished. He looks over at Weichert, who sits in a pile of sheaves on the ground and stares up at the ceiling. Grommel's breathing is loud and excited. He also gazes upwards. Whenever the tank fires a shot, the roof vibrates and dirt and snow fall down between the beams and planks onto our steel helmets. As the engine roars and the steel colossus again moves off, clods of frozen earth fall into the bunker and give us more of a glimpse of the tank track. Not buried alive. That's my main concern. Weichert and the others are panic-stricken.
Out of here! He cries in alarm, and is the first one to the door.
There are lumps of ice in front of the door. Weichert pushes them away with his feet and manages to squeeze out. The trench is half full of dirt and snow, and my machine gun is buried underneath it all. Further over in the trench, several Russian soldiers are moving around, and Varias and Zeidel are lobbing hand grenades over there. We can hear the sappers still firing from their trench. Grenades explode over us and land in front of our position. The sappers are trying to provide crossfire with their mortars. It stops the Russian infantry, but not the tank. The tank finally departs and moves towards the village. We realize that we have been dead lucky because the tracks show that the tank actually missed our bunker and only churned up the earth at the left edge. It is now firing at the sappers' machine gun position. We watch in horror as their position takes a hit and realize that the machine gun is now useless. Then he turns and comes back. The T-34 is now shooting at will in the connecting trenches. He rolls over them and turns round, churning up the frozen ground and filling them. Two soldiers, frightened and desperate, jump up and try to flee the trench, but seconds later they are cut down by the tank's machine gun. Another soldier bravely throws a hand grenade against the tank's turret. It smashes against it like a snowball on a wall. The man does not get away quickly enough and is ground down by the tank's tracks. The turret hatch opens and several hand grenades are lobbed into the trench. While I desperately try to dig my machine gun out from the dirt, Svina throws a hand grenade at two Russians who are storming towards us. They fall and writhe around in the snow. Weichert has no time to reload his carbine, so he snatches Grommels out of his hands and fires at the Russian who is about to jump into our trench. I hit the second Russian with a pistol shot. Blood drips from the wound in his throat. Crying, he runs back. Others run with him. Again, we have a little air. There are only a few Russians in the trenches now, but the T-34 churns on. He grinds down everything under him, and there is no one able to destroy him. Will this be the end? Will a single T-34 be able to destroy us all? The air is filled with terror, and also with anger and helplessness in the face of this steel monster. Another soldier whose nerves cannot stand the pressure of being in the trench gets up and out, and the tank turns around and runs him down, tearing him in half. A terrible sight to behold. Grommel's stomach turns, and he crawls back into the bunker. The tank churns over the position again and again. Then he slowly approaches our bunker. Are we next? Does he know that we're still in there and still alive? What should we do? Running away is no good, but the bunker could be our grave. In my subconscious, I hear several detonations in the village, and I remember the other tank. But my thoughts are concentrated on the steel colossus, which is now coming right at us, its engine screaming. It is firing at everything that moves, and in between the shots its machine gun rattles, spraying the blind spots. Is there no hope of salvation? In despair I send a quick prayer up to heaven, and notice that the others, helpless, are seeking cover. Will the monster miss us this time? Surely we won't be so lucky a second time. Or will we? I take one last look at the T-34, which is no more than 30 meters away. Then I suddenly feel transported from hell to heaven. My fright dissipates, and instead my blood begins to pump in excitement. Everything around me is forgotten, and I see only the tractor pulling the anti-tank gun appear over the hillock. Even before it comes to a halt, three men jump down, and in no time the gun is detached and swung into position. The gun layer is already turning his wheel to aim the weapon at the tank. Then the tank notices the ATG. The protagonists are no more than 100 meters apart. Slowly, the tank turret turns around, seeking its target. Who will fire first? It must be the ATG. But will he hit the enemy? That first shot will decide the outcome. I call the others out of the bunker and almost fall over in my excitement. Then a report tears through the charged air. A lightning-like explosion illuminates the surroundings, and with it comes the hit, right on the turret of the T-34. Seconds later comes another hit, lifting the turret and moving it sideways off the tank. Hurrah! A yell of delight issues from many a raw throat, the amazing release from the terrible despair of the last few hours. Saved! We were literally saved in the last second. Those wonderful fellows with the ATG won the battle with their first shot, cheating the hand of death hovering over us. I feel like giving that crew an enormous hug because of their heroic efforts. Svina, Grommel and Weichert are straightaway back to their old selves. As if stung by a bee, two Russians now dash out of Döring's bunker. In our jubilation, we hadn't noticed them. They're running for their lives back to where they came from. No shots are fired. Now there is a temporary ceasefire from both sides. We can't stand it in the trenches any longer. We climb out, and with us they all stream like rats out of their holes, dirty, pale, but happy that they have survived. Later we learn that today, in addition to the slightly and seriously wounded, we also have 8 dead to mourn. Some were apparently buried alive in their bunker by the tank. To our dismay and great sorrow, Unteroffizier Döring and 2 of his men also are among the dead. Among us in the trenches, Varias and Zeidel remain unscathed. Cooper was wounded in the head and shoulder and was driven down to the village with the other casualties. Meinhardt lost his machine gun because he had not managed to snatch it away before the tank tracks crushed it. Wilke survived the nightmare. Most of the soldiers from the ATG are now in the trenches, and Weichert and I go over to see them and to give them our heartfelt thanks for saving us. The ground between us and the hillock is all churned up and mixed in with snow. A new and peculiar type of odour is in the air. It comes from the mangled human flesh that covers the ground. I have somehow become used to seeing dead bodies, but this is a completely new and frightful experience. Those who lie here are not just dead bodies, with one wound in them or possibly with one part missing. Here are individual lumps of flesh from arms, legs, and buttocks, and in one instance from a head, onto which part of a damaged helmet still clings. These are the remains of the men of the 88mm AA gun and the Quad MG, both of which received direct hits from the T-34 and were blown apart, blasted into the air. I feel so miserable as we stumble forward. The 3 men from the brave ATG crew are still being thanked by another group of soldiers. The Geschützführer is an Unteroffizier. On his breast he is wearing the Iron Cross First Class and the Silver Wound Badge, proving that he has some experience behind him. In our eyes he is a hero, and had he not already got the Iron Cross First Class, he would certainly be awarded one now. The faces of the 3 are dirty, sweaty and unshaven under their steel helmets. The Unteroffizier looks familiar. Where have I seen him before? I walk towards them, and as he turns round I can recognize who it is. "Heinz! Heinz Rühmann!" I yell, startling the men nearby. The Unteroffizier has also recognized me in spite of my dirty face. Surprised and delighted at such an unexpected meeting here in this godforsaken bridgehead outside the Stalingrad pocket, we fall into each other's arms. Still amazed about the coincidence, he wants to know how and since when I have been assigned here to his unit. I explain the situation to him and reflect what a small world it really is and what chance meetings life often brings. In this vast country of Russia, where there are at the moment 1 million German soldiers, I happen to meet Heinz Rühmann, the youngest son of the principal at the primary and middle school in our hometown. And on top of that, it is he who saves not only me but all the others from a life-threatening situation, literally at the last second. Some 8 days ago, he arrived from Nizhnechirskaya at the Don bridgehead on the southern bank of the river. Yesterday, he had been ordered to give us support with his ATG against tank attacks. From Heinz, I also learned for the first time that our forces have established 2 bridgeheads on the south bank of the Don, manned by remnants from several units, and that our unit here is a so-called buffer unit in an advanced hedgehog defensive position. In other words, we are a sort of suicide unit. Asked about the other 3 tanks, he tells me that one ran onto a mine at the edge of the village. He caught the 2nd along the railway line, and the one which came from the northeast into the village was destroyed by our last tank, itself immobilized with track damage. We have a lot of news to exchange about our home area, but he has orders to return to his position in the village. As he is leaving, he calls back, telling me he will look out for me the next opportunity he has, so that we can catch up on old times. Unfortunately, it never comes to this. I never saw Heinz Rühmann again. I never did find out whether he was killed on the 13th of December in the village, whether he was one of those who remained behind at the Don, or whether he fell or was captured during the defensive campaigns on the Don and Chir. Moreover, his parents, whom I often saw during my next leave, and with whom I discussed our unusual encounter, never discovered what happened to him either. Meinhardt now assumes leadership of the